I don't know how many years, but give it another few years, it will not be a them and that us. It will be just anyone able to walk into a health service, able to get the most appropriate care, black, white, yellow, red, doesn't matter.
Hello and welcome back to the Uni Melbourne Student Life Podcast, exploring the misconceptions, realities and developments in careers for our students in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Science. My name's Dan Revez. I'm a third year biomedicine student, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Andy Sito, and a fantastic guest who I'll let Andy introduce.
Dr. Lau is a senior research fellow at the Department of General Practice, the University of Melbourne. She is an active member of the research and research training committees. She has extensive experience in Indigenous health research and has a national reputation for her work on cultural sensitivity in healthcare to meet the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and culturally and linguistically diverse groups. She is also the director of the Cultural Respect Encompassing Simulation Training Program, an innovative teaching and learning program that provides training in cultural sensitivity in communication. Thank you, Dr. Lau, for joining us today.
Thank you, Andy.
So as Andy described, you're currently a senior research fellow at the Department of General Practice at the university. Though we're often used to hearing about researchers in the context of biomedical research, it seems like there's quite a number of different roles that you play with the university in medical education and in research. So it might not be possible to give you a distinct job title to describe all of this. But do you think you could describe what sort of work you do in a few sentences for us?
So as Andy described, I wear quite a number of hats. And so it is part teaching. But I actually don't do that much teaching, really, only just in the MD3 itself, in the GP program. But most of my time is actually in research. And again, my research touches various arms. Indigenous health is one of those, and chronic disease management. But importantly, in that primary care space, it is the health service research that I do most. So also wear other hats too. Within the department, there is also the research higher degree. So I look after up to, at the moment, we have over 30 research higher degree students. You know, those students are PhD students and master's students. Primarily, I also look after the China program. So China program within the department, and that is our collaborative work. Mainly in research, but also in teaching with our Chinese partners in that primary care space again.
So you just talked about your research in terms of Indigenous health and primary clinical care. Could you describe a little bit more about what that involves?
So with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, there's always the consideration of their cultural needs. And of course, their great the disparity that they have in terms of health and other needs. So my research has mainly really evolved around meeting those culturally diverse needs that Aboriginal people have, not just in Victoria, in New South Wales and other states as well. So one of my key research, and I have two NHMRC grants. NHMRC stands for National Health and Medical Research Council grants. They are Category A grant. So I've got two of those that actually look at how do we help Australian, you know, mainstream general practice and primary care to be more culturally aware and culturally sensitive to their Aboriginal patients. So how do we attract patients firstly to come into the practice? To see a doctor, let's say, or to see any other primary care practitioners, and then how do we follow up, how do we appropriately care for them. So, and all my projects always involve the input of community. So we never do things for the community without involving the community. So it's very real-world type research, if you know what I mean.
Was there any particular person or particular incident that sort of motivated you and gave you the passion to work in this line of research?
I'm glad you asked that. There is a bit of, I always remember how I got involved in Indigenous health research. So when I started in this area, I was relatively fresh out of my PhD. And my PhD really was around more around disease management, I suppose. So after my PhD, we were really looking just mainly at diabetes and things like that. But I noticed that in our department, at that time, we're talking about more than 10 years ago, in our department, no one was doing anything in the Indigenous health area. So, there was a opportunity in NHMRC asking for some Indigenous-focused research proposals. So I sort of asked around my colleagues and asked, why isn't our department involved in doing this? It's so worthwhile. We know there are so much needs in that population. And one colleague, a very senior colleague, said to me, "Oh, it's too hard, Phyllis. You don't want to go there." And that was enough to trigger my what's going on? Why is it so hard? And I talked to a lot of people. So I talked to a lot of people. One thing you learn in academia is that when you talk to people, they give you leads, they give you contacts, and you follow them through. And I was like a dog in for going, something like that. And I went for it. I talked to anyone under the sun who was willing to talk to me. And of course, a lot of them were our Aboriginal friends. And in the end, we put together a proposal to look at the diabetes management of Aboriginal people in the urban area. So, and that got me my first NHMRC grant. The truth is, Aboriginal health research is actually very, very hard for many reasons. I won't go into them, and understandable reasons also, but it is very rewarding.
I suppose I was a bit curious to know without going into a whole academic kind of essay about it, but what does make it so difficult doing that, the research on Aboriginal populations?
So I think with working with the Aboriginal community, firstly, there's a lot of layers of bureaucracy that you need to negotiate and need to navigate. So I recall when I first started in this area, I was very naive. Partly because I am from overseas. I came from overseas many years ago. And my understanding of the history and all that, it wasn't quite there. I mean, I still have a lot to learn, but at that time, it was like practically zero. And I had to have very quick lessons to learn about some of the historical reasons around the bureaucracy, around the trust, around the distrust of the system. Like I said, I won't go into a lot of that, but those were all very understandable barriers. And that's one of them. Someone said to me, and it was also that colleague who said to me, "It's too hard, don't go there, Phyllis," said to me that whatever time you need to do a piece of research in other areas, multiply that by 3. That's how much time you will need to work in the Indigenous health area. I totally agree with that. But the important thing is to always remember, and I said that before, is that when you work in I don't like to use the word vulnerable, but you know what I mean, a community, a population that has got particular needs and particular cultural needs, you really must make sure that the community representative is right and center in everything that we do. So, with that, I was able to make a lot of inroads, not because of my own ability, but because I had a lot of our Aboriginal community friends and reps, pushing this forward.
You talked a little bit about this idea of bridging the gap and the distrust of the system that exists. It sounds like a lot of your work is really focused on changing the mindset of both the GPs that are working in those areas and also of the Aboriginal populations.
Absolutely. But things have improved a lot, I've been involved in this. I've been in this sort of research now for over 10 years. In the start, when you talk to GPs, when you talk to what we used to say, mainstream, primary care, a typical response would be, so what do we do for them? So is that us and them mentality? Or there are Aboriginal health services. Well, they can go there. You know, that's sort of a mentality. There was a lot of that. And of course, with a lot of government initiatives are really trying to bridge that gap. And that helped with our research also. I think a lot of what my research is about is raising awareness, but not just raising awareness. Raising awareness is the easiest thing to do. I always said to my students, make sure you read papers and watch TV. You will be aware. It's the easiest thing to do. But it's not just raising awareness, but knowing what to do. So a lot of healthcare practitioners, particularly because they're time poor and, you know, all that. So they like to know very practically what can they do, you know, what are some of the instruments and tools that they could use immediately to make sure that they are managing the patients well. So it is about making sure that, you know, practically we can improve the whole system. I always said that, you know, given another, I don't know how many years, but given another few years, there will not be a them and that us. It will be just anyone able to walk into a health service, able to get the most appropriate care, black, white, yellow, red, doesn't matter. So that's what we do all the time. I have a lot of hope in this area. And you're right, you know, to bridge the gap, it's always both sides moving into the center to bridge that gap. And I don't want to focus on the negative, you know, on either side. But, you know, over the last 10 years, 10 years isn't very long. Over the last 10 years, I've seen so many changes on both sides, and it's all towards the center. And a lot of the misconceptions that we, you know, non-Aboriginal people have of Aboriginal people or other races, you know, sometimes, and because I've been involved in this area for so long, I know it's not true. Like, for instance, alcoholism and all that, you know, we see a lot of what the news tell us. You know, our image of the Aboriginal people are so stereotyped, are so stereotypical, you know, it's sometimes not funny. A lot of my Aboriginal friends do not touch a drop of alcohol, partly because they don't like it, but partly because of that, you know, they want to prove a point that they are not anywhere near that. I really have a lot of hope in the future, and the younger generation too. I mean, I know so many young, you know, Aboriginal, you know, people who are brilliant, who are clever, who are, you know, everything that you would expect. So, you know, I have a lot of hope.
It seems like, I mean, you mentioned that this was a very difficult field to get into, as well as a very rewarding field to get into. In terms of the listeners who are listening into this podcast today, are there any recommended resources or website, or what do you think that listeners can do if they want to find out a little bit more about this culture of you?
That's an interesting question. I think, so let's talk about Aboriginal health research firstly. If you want to work in this area, firstly, to find out who are some of the leading researchers in this area, have a quick chat, you know, send an email. We're always happy to answer any emails, you know, yeah, even if it's from a student who asks maybe quite some quite basic questions, that's fine. And have a chat about, you know, what you think you might, well, you know, be able to contribute. Another way, and I think in the MDHS space, there's a lot of opportunity for that, is you get involved with going to see what it's like in Aboriginal health services. So there might be opportunity for placements and things like that. And people there are always very welcoming. So getting involved with the community, getting involved with NAIDOC Week is a great opportunity. It's fun also. And just getting to know a few Aboriginal friends always help. If not just for, you know, getting involved in research, but just getting to demystify some of those stereotypes that we still have in amongst a lot of people.
So it might be a bit of a late question following on from what we've already talked about, but you talked a little bit about having done a PhD and now working in primary care and Aboriginal health. Could you tell us a little bit about your education and your early career as well, and how you got into this kind of space, if you did science or medicine at some stage, or what kind of route that you took?
So I did pharmacy. So my PhD is in pharmacy practice, and my thesis is around the management of adverse drug reactions in oncology in cancer. So following that, I got a job as a research manager at Monash University, managing a large research project that is across the different states. And that's what gave me a real insight as to the multi-center and multidisciplinary type research. But then shortly after that, wasn't very long, I then landed with a job in the Department of General Practice. So, and then that is, I was actually seconded over because of my pharmacy background to look at complementary medicine in the Chinese population that they use for diabetes. So I was seconded to help with the project at the department. And then after that, I just stayed on with the different projects happening. And there was an opening for a research coordinator for primary healthcare research. That was a government initiative. So after I got the job, I just went to the department. And again, not long after that, I got my first NHMRC grant to my research. I think the important thing is after you do a PhD or after your studies is to know where you want to go. So I was very clear that I wanted to stay in academia. So I involved myself in academia. And during that time, fresh out of PhD, I made sure I surrounded myself with mentors. I think at that time, I have no less than 4 mentors. And I chose them for particular reasons, how they could help me to mentor and progress where I want to go. So it is important to do that. If you're not sure what you want to do, where you want to end up, I mean, you guys nowadays have so much more, your opportunities are so much worse during my time. So I encourage you to be open-minded and focus, I suppose, one thing at a time rather than have all your fingers in different pots. That could make it hard to really experience what it is you want to do. I hope that makes sense. But the key thing for me is that I surrounded myself with people that I like and people that I know could mentor me.
How did you go about selecting mentors, in that case, those four people?
Okay, so I remember who we know it. So I selected someone who is an expert and, you know, a go-getter in that field. Now, initially, when I wasn't in Indigenous health research, I chose a very, very well-respected and well-known primary care researcher who happens to be a GP. So that was my first one, yeah? A second one I selected was someone who has integrity, fierce integrity, because that was very important to me, you know, because you don't want, you know, anything to eat your soul up. So I wanted someone like that. So someone I know, I respect, you know, wholeheartedly. Everything they say is a bit like, you know, like God said, that something. Not like that, but you know. So someone like that. And then I chose someone who is nearer to my level, but has been there, done that, sort of, you know, a little bit further ahead. So that it's not so far away that they can't remember how high it is, but enough for them to tell me, you know, this is the next step. This is the right person to talk to. You know, don't go there because you waste 3 months doing nothing, going down that road. And I cannot remember what's the fourth one. I think I just got, you know, someone who was, you know, good at what they do. But the important thing is you must like them. You know, no point choosing someone that you don't like. So get to know. So don't you know, climb up to someone and say, can you be my mentor? Get to know them first, you know. Friends, do a bit of coffee. If you know you like them, then fine. I mean, if you don't like them, doesn't matter how eminent they are, it's not going to work.
It's a bit like the start to a relationship or something. I was thinking when you say you take them out for coffee, you suss out what they're like, if you like them. But it is a very useful thing. I think Andy and I probably do very similar things in that we talk to people in the years above us who've done similar subjects and can recommend where to go and where we could possibly go wrong as well, what kind of path we might take in the future. And obviously talking to people that are more senior academics gives us a little bit more of an overview of what we might be able to do in the future. I just wanted to come back to a little bit about like your motivations for what you do. You talked very passionately, especially about the primary care in Aboriginal communities, and talked a little bit about addressing the misconceptions that exist and alleviating a lot of those kind of problems that are entrenched in the community and in the mindsets between the practitioners and the community itself. What are the kind of primary motivations that drive you to do this? If you like, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
That's a really hard question, but I love what I do. I love what I do, and I'm good at what I do. So, I wasn't good at what I do just right from the start, but over the years, I've accumulated a lot of experience. And so in terms of teaching students, so I do a lot of teaching in the research space to our graduate research students. It's a lot around, you know, just imparting that knowledge around what works, what don't work, and what are the potholes that people should avoid, and what are things that people should be aware of. In my area, particularly around cultural sensitivity. So I also teach a cultural competency. It's not a module, but a session to our GR students around how to involve community and all that. So I just love, you know, letting people know that you know what work and what don't. And of course, things change and time change and all that. So a lot of times I learn from other people. So I learn from the students constantly. So it is that knowledge exchange. I think I always said that, you know, in academia and studying, you need to have a curious mind. You need to be curious and wanting to know. So I suppose another thing that motivates me is wanting to know more about what's going on, what's happening out there. And the only way to do that is be part of it.
I think really the essence of a scientist in that way, to have the curiosity about the unknown. And I think Andy and I have talked about this a little bit, more so in the context of research with neuroscience, but a lot about the intrigue and the motivation that comes from not knowing. And I think that's the interest in science and the beauty and the mystery of it as well, that all comes together. But it's beautiful when it can translate into having those real-life clinical applications and implications for people as well. Well, thank you very much, Phyllis, for that. That was absolutely beautiful to hear about your motivations and the real passion you speak about in terms of helping communities and translating those ideas and mindsets that you talked about. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.